When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Since its release, this 80s flick is still considered by many to be one of the best war movies ever made. The director, who himself was wounded twice while serving with the U.S. Army in Vietnam, famously put his cast through a grueling boot camp to help immerse them into the world of their fictional characters. With an all-star cast and loads of visually striking practical effects, this Vietnam War epic won more awards than any other film during the 59th Academy Awards. So prepare for digging foxholes, waking up with ant bites, and surviving ambush duty as J.B. Huffman and I discuss Platoon from 1986 on this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast.
I volunteered. I dropped out of college and told them I wanted the infantry, combat, Vietnam.
Out of the hole, fast!
Take the pain.
Take the pain!
I got a bad feeling on this one, all right?
Watch out! Rocket!
Tom Berenger, Willem Dafoe, Charlie Sheen.
No such thing as a coward out here, don't mean nothing.
The first real movie about the war in Vietnam is Platoon, rated R.
Hello, movie viewers and movie lovers. My name is Tim Williams, the creator and host of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. On each episode, I'm joined by an 80s flick-loving guest co-host to talk about one of the great and sometimes not-so-great movies from the 1980s. From blockbusters to cult classics to lesser-known treasures we discovered on cable TV or the now-defunct video rental stores from our childhood. No matter which 80s flick we choose for each episode, we have a lot of fun sharing first-time watch memories, discussing our favorite iconic scenes, and even learning some behind-the-scenes stories about the cast and crew along the way. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe and follow 80s Flick Flashback on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your favorite podcast platform is. And while you're there, leave us a stellar written review and a 5-star rating. You can also support the show by following us on our social media pages. Just search for 80s Flick Flashback on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And don't forget to check out our website, 80sflickflashback.com, as well. If you want to take your support to the next level, you can become a financial partner for less than $10 a month. The link to financially support the podcast is located in our episode show notes. And while you're there, be sure to check out more fun facts and behind-the-scenes trivia we just weren't able to fit into today's episode. Thanks for listening. Now, on with the show. Well, welcome in, everybody. So glad to have you on this very patriotic and memorable, as it's Memorial Day weekend, podcast episode of the 80s Flick Flashback, talking about the movie Platoon from 1986. Since it's such a manly movie, I figured I'd have the host of the Manly Movies podcast on here with me. He's been on before. Please welcome Mr. J.B. Huffman to the show once again. How you doing, J.B.?
What up? What up? I'm doing well, man. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good. A lot to talk about with this movie for sure. You had sent me like a behind the scenes thing to watch, which I did watch and was really good. And then I saw one today I sent to you that I don't think you got a chance to watch, but I think I fully immersed myself in this movie, probably more so than I have some other ones that we've done in the past. But doing the research and seeing what these actors went through for this movie makes you appreciate it a little bit more. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we get going. But let's jump right into the regular format. When did you see Platoon for the first time?
I saw bits and pieces of it when I was younger.
Right.
I never actually saw it from start to finish until about 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
I watched it on Netflix, and immediately after watching it, I I had an old, I had a DVD of it that I had never watched.
Like, oh, wow.
I had it laying around. And so I was like, I'm going to pop this DVD in after I already watched it on Netflix.
Right.
And see what all special features are. And then that's when I saw that Tour of the Inferno.
Right.
The documentary on it. And I just watched it immediately. And I was mm-hmm. just like enthralled.
Mm-hmm.
But then, I, of course, I watched it again the other day. So this is only my second time to watch it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is not one that I saw in the theater. I know I watched this one on VHS, but this came out right like the late 80s was right around the time that I was really getting into like the Academy Awards and what critics had to say about movies and kind of those type, you know, more of what the Academy was, not just blockbusters or not just like silly, you know, popcorn movies, but like really like serious dramas and things of that nature. But I was also really too young to understand a lot of the movie. So I remember watching it. I'm pretty sure I watched this with my dad. My dad was in the Army. He did not serve in Vietnam, but he knew people that did. So I don't remember really us talking about Vietnam that much, but we watched action movies. And I think that's kind of what I expected it to be going in as a kid, you know, thinking it was going to be just, you know, because around that time you had the Rambo movies, you had mm-hmm. you know, Top Gun, those kind of movies that were, you know, kind of action war movies, but that's not what this was at all. And so I don't remember if I really liked it that much when I was younger, because I don't think I really understood it. And it wasn't until probably, I've probably seen it a few times. It's not one that I would, you know, readily run back to watch, but I think I watched it again, like really wanting to watch it probably about 10 or 12 years ago, maybe. One of my friends had referenced it, had like sent me like a picture or something, referenced the movie. And I was like, you know, I haven't seen that in a long time. And I actually just went, this is before, you know, you could stream movies really. And mm-hmm. so I was trying to find somewhere to get it. And I was like, well, I'll just go buy it. So I went to a Blockbuster, not a Blockbuster, good gracious. I went to a Best Buy and actually just kind of rummaged back when they sold a bunch of DVDs. And kind of rummaged through the store and found a copy, you know, pretty cheap, and watched it. And it hit me differently that time. But really watching it this time, I think I grasped a lot more of what the movie was wanting to say and wanting to depict, more than just looking for a typical, you know, like storytelling or a typical like overarching plot, you know. That you know, there was no final mission. There was no, like, you know, an enemy or a specific bad guy they were all trying to fight. So seeing it was different. So I guess I kind of answered my last question. When was the last time I saw it before watching it, the podcast? It's probably been that long since I really sat down and watched it. So I know you said you've only seen it twice, but what was the difference watching it the second time for you?
I definitely understood more about, because after I watched it the first time and then I saw the documentary and, mm-hmm. and understood more about what Oliver was going for with this film.
Right.
I definitely understood that he wanted this to be like semi-autobiographical.
Right.
Supposedly. And those characters are real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, based on people that he met in Vietnam. And so, I mean, I understood that he wanted people to understand what they went through. Like, mm-hmm. and he wanted the actors to understand what they went to, because they're not actually going to act that part. I don't think anybody understood the war in Vietnam.
Right.
Like,
right.
And that's why there were so many protests.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I think he wanted to put that out there for everyone else. And he had to do the method acting with the actors and put mm-hmm. them in boot camp and put them in the jungle and give them rations to eat and all this stuff, which we'll talk about later, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But it makes it that much more immense when you understand where Oliver Stone was coming from there.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah.
Such a feel good movie, man.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. We were talking about that before we started recording. Like, what a fun movie to discuss, and, you know, all sunshine and rainbows. No, but let's talk a little bit about, you know, we always talk about story during pre-production, so we're kind of hinting a little bit at it, but for those that don't really know much about how this movie was made, and I do recommend going and watching, we'll reference the documentaries or the behind the scenes features. Most of them you can find on YouTube now if you don't have the DVD, but They're really good because it does give you some good insights into the filming and what, like I said, what Oliver Stone was trying to accomplish with this movie. But Oliver Stone's journey of creating a cinematic piece about his tour of duty in the Vietnam War began almost after it ended in 1968 when he wrote a Vietnam screenplay called Break, a semi-autobiographical account detailing his experiences with his parents and his time in the Vietnam War. His active duty service resulted in a big change in how he viewed life and the war. He wrote the screenplay based on his experiences as a U.S. infantryman in Vietnam to counter the vision of the war portrayed in movies like John Wayne's The Green Berets, which he talks a little bit about in the documentary about how, maybe it wasn't him, but I think it was Dye, the military advisor. He was like, you know, they had both seen all these war movies and they would watch them like, you know, this isn't what war really is. This is Hollywood's pipe dream of these, you know, elaborate plans for getting the enemy and those kind of things. And so he's like, that wasn't our experience. So although the screenplay Break was never produced, he later used it as the basis for Platoon. His screenplay featured several characters who were the seeds of those he developed in Platoon. Although Break was never produced, Stone decided to attend film school anyway. After writing several other screenplays in the early 70s, Stone worked with Robert Bolt on a screenplay that was never produced called The Cover-Up. But Bolt's rigorous approach rubbed off on Stone. The younger man used his characters from the Break screenplay and developed a new screenplay, which he titled Platoon. Producer Martin Bregman attempted to elicit studio interest in the project, but was not successful. Stone claims that during that time, Sidney Lumet was to have helmed the film with Al Pacino slated to star had there been studio interest. But based on the strength of his writing in Platoon, Stone was hired to write the screenplay for the movie Midnight Express from 1978. The film was a critical and commercial success, as were some other Stone films at the time, including Scarface, but most studios were still reluctant to finance Platoon because it was about the unpopular Vietnam War. After the release of The Deer Hunter and Apocalypse Now, the studios then cited the perception that these films were considered the pinnacle of the Vietnam War film genre as reasons not to make Platoon. So he had a lot of opposition going into this. So Stone responded by attempting to break into mainstream direction via the easier-to-finance horror genre, but failed at the box office, and he began to think Platoon would never be made. Instead, he co-wrote Year of the Dragon for a lower-than-usual fee of $200,000 on the condition that its producer, Dino De Laurentiis, would next produce Platoon. Year of the Dragon was directed by Stone's friend Michael Cimino, who had also helmed The Deer Hunter, and according to Stone, Cimino attempted to produce Platoon in 1984. De Laurentiis secured financing for Platoon, but struggled to find a distributor. Because he'd already spent money sending Stone to the Philippines to scout for locations, he decided to keep control of the film script until he was repaid. Then Stone's script for what would become Salvador was passed to John Daly of British production company Hemdale. Once again, this was a project that Stone had struggled to secure financing for, but Daly loved the script and was prepared to finance both Salvador and Platoon. So Stone shot Salvador first before turning his attention to Platoon. Basically, it took a long time to get this movie made. I think they said it was a 10-year passion project for him to get the movie made.
Yeah, and it's only like his, what, second or third directed movie?
Yeah, I think it was third, because he did the horror movie, then he did Salvador, which he said was panned by the critics and nobody loved it. So he thought that, he's like, there's no way they're going to let me make Platoon now, but it was already in process, and he was like, oh, this is, which I think is why he poured so much more into Platoon, because he was trying to kind of recover from what Salvador didn't deliver on.
Yeah. So with your third movie, you win Best Picture and
Best Director.
You're a household name, right?
Right. Hey, it happens that way for some guys, I guess. As we mentioned before, and this is what a lot, like the two documentaries we've talked about, and the one you said is called Into the Inferno. Is that the name of that one?
Tour of the Inferno.
Tour of the Inferno, which is about 38 minutes. And then I watched one today. It's an hour. Okay. Yeah. It was an hour. I think
50 something minutes.
Yeah. I think originally I thought it was like 38 minutes, but it was an hour. The one I watched today is like closer to an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And it was, let's see.
Brothers in Arms, I think is what it was called.
Brothers in Arms, The Making of Platoon, which is actually from 2018. It's a little bit newer than the one that you had sent me. But in both of those, like, the bulk of what they talk about is this quote unquote boot camp that that Oliver Stone and Dale Dye kind of immersed them into, the actors. And so we're going to kind of briefly, like, broad strokes talk about it. But if you want the, you know, all the fun stories they tell, and, you know, and both of those are really good, like, a lot better than some other behind the scenes stuff I've seen for other movies where you have a lot of the cast, you know, telling their story. So it wasn't just like one person's, you know, perspective. And really watching both of them, there's some that are in one that aren't in the other, and vice versa. So you kind of get other perspectives from some of the other actors as well. But all the actors had to undergo an intensive 2-week basic training in the Philippines, where the movie was shot, under the supervision of military advisor Dale Dye, who was also a Vietnam veteran. Oliver Stone's intention was not to have the men bond and act as one unit, but to deprive them of sleep and make them utterly exhausted so they would be burnt out and therefore in character. The actors were given military haircuts and required to stay in character throughout the camp. They ate only military rations, were not allowed to shower or use toilets, had to carry real weight, slept in the jungle, and even had rotations for night watch. Military advisor Dale Dye also simulated several combat situations to teach the actors how to respond under intense stress, and had many conversations with the cast about PTSS and the sensation of being shot. Tom Berenger said he lost 28 pounds during the pre-filming boot camp, and the filming for the movie began the very next day after the camp ended. So they didn't get any kind of reprieve, really, from going from the boot camp, quote unquote, to actual shooting the movie. And they talked about how that opening shot of them kind of walking through the jungle, they said that was like, that was the very first thing they shot. Like, they had, so they had done the, they had finished the boot camp training, and they, quote unquote, graduated. And then they all went to this bar and, like, all got, like, completely drunk and on this, like, Vietnamese moonshine. And they said they all woke up and had the worst hangover, and just, they had got hardly gotten any sleep, and they're on this bus going to where they're going to start shooting. And he's like they hadn't showered. They were still in the clothes they had on the day before. And this Oliver's like, okay, go ahead, we're going to hike up this hill. And he said the look that they had was this exhausted, you know, not quite ready for what they're about to embark on. And he was like, Dale Dye and Oliver Stone was like, yep, they look like they've been in Vietnam for about a year, which is what we want them to look like. They look tired and exhausted and want to go home. And that's exactly how they felt. So it's pretty incredible. The, you know, method acting, as we would call it, but method directing, I guess, as well, because he really wanted to put them in those situations. He wanted them to feel it. He didn't want them to pretend it. He wanted them to feel it for sure.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting. Like, a lot of the stuff, like, they didn't have like a set designer, like all those foxholes that you see in the movie, the actors had to build them themselves. Mm-hmm. They had to dig them all out.
Right.
Like, this was legit soldier stuff, right?
Yeah.
And just a glimpse of the conditions that they were in. There's one scene or one thing that Willem Dafoe was talking about, where he said that they had to drink water out of canteens that they got from the streams that they had just cut. Any stream that they came across, they had to fill their canteens up.
Right.
So he's drinking water out of this canteen for a while, and then they get up this exact same stream that they just got water out of, and they see this dead pig laying in the water.
Yep.
Like it just made his stomach turn.
Yeah. Anyway. He was pretty sick for a couple of days, and and I think I heard you say that story. He said they'd given him the little like pills or the things you could put in the water that's supposed to help kill any bacteria or whatever. He said, but it wasn't going to kill that, you know, all that, the water that had flushed that dead pig coming through. And then on one of the, it's bad. And then on this other documentary, the guy who played Doc was telling the story. Like he said, you know, they came up on Willem Dafoe and he was like shivering. He was like, he could, you know, like he was totally pale. Like they could tell, like, this dude is not doing good. And they went to Dale Dye's like, hey man, I don't think Dafoe, he looks bad, man. He looks really bad. We got to do something. And he said, Dale Dye looked at him and said, do what you can. He said, we're miles from any kind of medical facility. He was like, even if we tried to move him, I don't know what they would be able to do for him. It's like, you got to figure it out. And that was just that guerrilla style filmmaking. Like I said, they all called it like, it was this little, cheap independent film we were making. It does not look cheap or independent at all. No. Yeah. So they did really well. Going back to that whole method directing, it's well documented in these documentaries and stuff that Oliver Stone was very rough and abusive to the actors during the filming. According to John C. McGinley, everyone hated Stone for the entire duration of the shoot. But this was his specific aim in order to expose the cast to something resembling the horrors of war and get the most realistic performances. Most cast and crew members agree that Stone's behavior sometimes bordered on psychotic from a combination of sleep deprivation, post-traumatic stress disorder, and the intensity of the shoot itself. The editor claimed that one day Stone yelled at him for taking away footage of a scene that they hadn't even shot yet. Johnny Depp recalled that during one particularly stressful scene, he was so intimidated by Stone's aggressive behavior that he came close to throwing up. But yeah, those are just a few of the stories. Like there was, there's a lot of stories about the things that he did. And either he said it was psychological. There's a lot of stuff he did was getting in their heads. It wasn't so much about beating them down physically, but he was kind of emotionally and mentally tormenting them. And they said there was one story where one of the other actors had like this idea for a monologue. I think it's really good. And so Stone's like, oh yeah, we'll do it. And so they had the camera in there and they were making the shot. And and Charlie Sheen was saying that like Stone says, yeah, I need you to be in the shot, but you're just in the background. He said, what do you want me to do? He said, I want you to take these two pails of water. I just want you to walk from one side to the other. He's like, well, why am I doing that? He's like, well, it's like you're taking the pails. You're one is full. You're emptying the pails and then going across to get more water. And Charlie's like, well, can I empty the buckets? He's like, no, it doesn't matter. Just walk back and forth. So he's walking back and forth with like full pails of water for like an hour or whatever. And that's going to wear you down anyway. And so, but then to the actor that had offered him, want to do this monologue that he had written, Stone kept interrupting him and not letting him finish. And like said, it went on and on and on. And so Charlie said after they decided to like rap or whatever, he said he went to the assistant director. He's like, man, why are we doing all this? How important is this scene? And he said the assistant director's like, dude, there's no film in the camera. It's like this is just Oliver Stone being Oliver Stone. He just wants to wear everybody out and just mess with their heads. It's like, oh my gosh, crazy, crazy.
Oh man.
Yeah.
But I mean, the finished product though, I think it was Tom Berenger who was talking mm-hmm. about how real it was in that, even Oliver and Dale Dye were speechless mm-hmm. at times. Like yeah. they would finish a scene and they would just be like completely with no words for about mm-hmm. 30 seconds or so. And then they'd be like, okay, that's it. Cut.
Yeah.
he said he thinks that they were having flashbacks.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that in a couple of different places. And I think a couple of them kind of said that it's almost like they were in a trance. It was like there would be moments where they would be shooting a scene and you could just look over at them and like they were like completely somewhere else. And they said that they felt like they were having those flashbacks of being there because, like you said, he wrote some of these scenes to be very true to the things that he experienced. And so I think Charlie Sheen talked about it that there were times I had to wrap my mind around that I'm acting out things that the director actually did in real life. He said, and to mm-hmm. be directing something that you experienced firsthand and watching someone else do it has got to be like mentally, weird, or just like very yeah. hard to comprehend. It becomes a surreal experience. So, he's like, I understand why he was rough and that he did the things he did because, some of it was just somebody said, Oliver Stone is like, the way he plays a filmmaker, he's like, even when he's not making the movies, like he likes to stir up the drama or create chaos and then film people trying to respond to the chaos. And he's like, that's how the whole shoot was, like just creating these things where you're getting the actors to react in a certain way so that he can capture that on film. And I was like, well, that sounds like a lot of directors. That's what they do. I mean, that's what makes it, you know, watchable. You want to see those conflicts. You want to see that, you know, you want to see that action in the movies for sure between the characters. But one cool note, then we'll go into casting. But with this movie, Oliver Stone became the first Vietnam veteran to direct a major motion picture about the Vietnam War. He was already the first Vietnam veteran to win an Oscar for Midnight Express and became, with this film, the first Vietnam vet to win an Oscar for Best Director. As of 2016, he is the last veteran of any war to win an Oscar for Best Director.
And now, these messages.
Now playing on a cell phone near you. A show for all the manly men out there, where guys talk about their favorite movies and what they can teach us about being a man. Featuring the coolest guests.
Murder somebody is not like killing an ant.
The most gratifying laughs.
It's Tombstone, what can I say?
And a fresh take on movies like you've never heard before.
This will be the thing that gets written on his proverbial tombstone.
We aren't here to criticize the movies you love, but to praise them for how they apply to our lives as husbands, fathers, and really all men in general. So buckle up your seatbelts, because Manly Movies is here. Subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or your other favorite podcast catcher. And remember, man up.
What seems to be the problem, pal?
There's just so much pain in the world, so many issues. I don't think I can bear it.
Well, friendo, it sounds like you could use a dose of Pop Culture Roulette.
Pop Culture Roulette? What's that? Some sort of pop culture-themed podcast or something?
That's right, sonny boy. When hope seems far, dive into some PCR.
But I already get my entertainment news from Variety.
Huh, that's pretty good. If you're a chucklehead, PCR gives you news you need, condensed, unfiltered, and raw, from three nerds who know a little something about something.
Wow, okay, sign me up.
That's the spirit. Pop Culture Roulette. New episodes every Monday, available on all major podcast directories.
Comic books have been around for almost a century, and in the last two decades, we've finally gotten to see many of these characters brought to life in movies and on TV. On the Moving Panels podcast, we discuss movies and TV shows based on, inspired by, and adapted from the world of comic books. Join me and my guests as we discuss both the good and the bad from Marvel, DC, and even some of the lesser-known comic book companies. Learn what is and isn't from the comics, as well as our nerdy review of the movie or show. New episodes drop every Monday, and you can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. So join us for Moving Panels, and I'll see you on the other side of the page.
All right, so let's jump into casting. There's a lot of people in this, and as I've said before in other episodes, we can't hit everybody. I'm going to try to be kind of brief with some of the stuff, just kind of hit the ones that either to me were more memorable in the movie and others that you would recognize from other things that they've done in their career. But first of all, we'll talk about who almost was in this movie, and that's James Woods, who had starred in Stone's earlier film, Salvador. He was offered a part. Despite his friendship with the director, he turned it down, later teasingly saying he couldn't, quote unquote, couldn't face going into another jungle with Oliver Stone. After hearing the stories, what they went through, it was probably a good choice for him. I'm sure once was enough.
I'll bet. And thinking about like some of the stuff that Oliver Stone has done in the past, it seems like all of his movies are very like visceral in the action
What's
going on. Like that is his shtick, man. Mm-hmm. It all started with him trying to recreate his conditions in the Vietnam War, which is insane.
I agree. Yeah. All right. So we'll start with the main character, Chris Taylor, played by a very young Charlie Sheen. Sheen was actually born as Carlos Estevez. He's the youngest son of course, actor Martin Sheen, whose real name is Ramon Estevez. Sheen's career began in 1983 when he was cast to portray Ron in Grizzly 2, The Predator, the sequel to the 1976 low-budget horror movie Grizzly, which remained unreleased until 2020. In 1984, he had a role in the Cold War teen drama Red Dawn with Patrick Swayze, C. Thomas Howell, Lee Thompson, and Jennifer Grey. Sheen and Grey reunited in a small scene in Ferris Bueller's Day Off in 86. He had his first major role in this movie, Platoon, in 86. In 87, he starred with his father in Wall Street, also directed by Oliver Stone. He, in 1988, he asked Sheen to star in the film Born on the 4th of July, but decided to cast Tom Cruise instead. Sheen was never notified by Stone. He only found out when he heard the news from his brother, Emilio. but he also starred in 1988. He starred in the baseball film Eight Men Out as outfielder Happy Felsch. Also in 88, he appeared opposite his brother Emilio Estevez in Young Guns, and again in 1990 in Minute Work. Sheen's had a long career. I mean, I kind of hit some of the stuff in the 80s, but he's been around. Well, he was around for a long time. He kind of hit his end of his career in the 2000s, and we won't go into that.
Nuts.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Tiger blood and winning. That's all you need to say. But yeah.
You skipped Charlie Sheen and Tom Berenger coming back together in 1989.
For a Major League.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, I think I mentioned it when I think I mentioned it in Tom Berenger stuff. But yeah, I wasn't going to forget that.
Gotcha.
Yeah. All good. Yeah, and it's funny because I just watched Major League like last week. So it's still fresh in my mind. And then seeing in this movie, I was like, yeah, I could see them wanting to do a movie like Major League after being in the jungle. You know, it's like, yeah, let's do this funny, silly, you know, baseball movie where we get to, you know, cut loose and be silly. So that was good. And then, of course, because he was also in the Hot Shots movies, the parodies. Mm-hmm. And there's somebody in this movie, I think, that was in that with him as well. I don't remember. Or maybe I'm thinking about something else. I don't know. But yeah. Stone verified in an interview that Keanu Reeves actually turned down the role of Taylor because of the violence. And originally, when the movie was originally going to be happen in 84, Charlie Sheen was turned down for the main role because it was felt he was too young for the part. And actually, his older brother Emilio Estevez was offered the part, but the project fell apart due to financial problems. But 2 years later, the project was given the go-ahead, but Estevez had already committed to other projects. So Charlie was able to read for the part again and won it. So I thought that was pretty interesting that both brothers were in contention for the same role. And then, of course, we have to bring up that their father had done Apocalypse Now, which was, you know, a very big Vietnam War movie. And I didn't put it in the notes, but watching the documentary, I forget that Charlie Sheen was with his dad in the Philippines when he was filming Apocalypse Now. He said he was there for about 8 weeks. And when he left, he vowed he would never go back to the Philippines. And then he said, then he got this movie and he had to go back. So, so he talked a little bit about, you know, if you, you know, that's its own story, Apocalypse Now, but that was a pretty rough, movie to shoot as well. I want to say that, Martin Sheen had a heart attack on the filming of
Apocalypse Now.
So it was very stressful. Moving right along with Mr. Tom Berenger as Staff Sergeant Barnes, which I know we'll kind of get to later, but I have to say, I'll wait. All right. So Berenger starred in several significant films in the 80s, including The Big Chill in 83, Eddie and the Cruisers, also in 83, Rustler's Rhapsody in 85, Shoot to Kill in 88, which is one of my favorites. And of course, we mentioned Major League in 89. He did receive an Academy Award nomination for his portrayal of Barnes in Platoon. It did win him a Golden Globe Award for Best Supporting Actor. So, of course, he did other movies and other notable films like Born on the 4th of July in 89, Shattered in 91. He's been in a bunch of stuff. I think most recently, I mean, I think one of the most recent movies I don't know him from is Inception, because he was great in that one. I think he's been in some other stuff since then. But Tom Berenger's great actor. He was great in this.
Yeah, he played somebody that you really, 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 really hated.
Yeah, exactly.
And only good actors can do that.
Right.
Him and John Voight, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah. Talked about him on Runaway Train. But yeah, it's interesting because he's kind of the one character that you don't see another side of. Like, all the other characters have their moments, you know, but he's like the one constant through the whole movie. Like, Barnes is who Barnes is from the beginning of the movie to the end. There's no changing him. Which is needed for this type of that type of storytelling and that type of movie. But I just thought that was interesting. But like, yeah, everybody else is the war affects them all differently in how they, you know, how they change over the course of the movie. But, you know, Barnes is Barnes from the beginning. Stone confirmed in an interview with the Entertainment Weekly that Mickey Rourke and Kevin Costner were also considered for the part of Barnes. He believes Costner turned down the role because his brother had actually been in Vietnam, so he didn't want to be in that movie. So then we'll move on to Sergeant Elias, played by Willem Dafoe. He made his film debut in Heaven's Gate in 1980, but was fired during production and was uncredited despite one of his scenes making it in the final cut of the movie. He was also in Streets of Fire in 84, To Live and Die in L.A. in 85, before his breakthrough roles in The Last Temptation of Christ in 88 and Mississippi Burning, also in 88. Sorry. he also received an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor for Platoon. He's been nominated several times for other movies. Of course, he's known more recently as supervillain Norman Osborn and the Green Goblin in the Spider-Man movies. Willem Dafoe played a great role in this as well.
Probably my favorite character in the movie, honestly.
Yeah, yeah.
Elias.
What I thought was cool, that according to Stone, he said he intentionally cast Barringer and Willem against type. Barringer was mostly famous for playing good guys, and Dafoe was primarily had played villains up until that point. Both men received Oscar nominations for their work. That's pretty smart. You put them against type. Yeah, I was going to kind of wait and talk about like favorite characters. I don't want to say Barnes is my favorite character because I don't like who he is, but Tom Berenger is so good that role. I mean, it's just, you know, how he didn't win an Academy Award for that, I do not know. I don't even know. I should have looked up at who beat him. I don't remember. And the antagonism, is that the right word?
Antagonist.
Yeah, how they're so antagonist against each other. Like that whole, not yin and yang, I guess, but their polar opposite personalities really, I mean, that holds the core of the movie up until that point where, spoiler alert, you know, Barnes shoots Elias in the jungle and leaves him for dead, thinking he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, those were two great characters and two actors that definitely played the parts well.
Yeah, for sure. Like you said, the yin and the yang, and I was sitting there trying to figure out who won the best actor that year. Mm-hmm. But no, yeah, they did play two polar opposites. And Charlie Sheen at the end, he talks about how in a voiceover how both of them like kind of has some kind of influence over him and made him kind of who he is. As bad as Barnes was, I mean, you're still going to get something out of him just because he's such a hardcore. I mean, there's some things you could take from that, even if he is a bad dude. So
right, exactly. And that was one thing. They were talking to different critics and people about the movie and one of the documentaries, and one guy said it really well, and I should have wrote it down, but he said the one thing that Platoon did in changing how these type of movies were made is that it showed you that there's good and evil in all of us. You know, they can both reside. I think he said they can all reside in the same breast, I guess, meaning like in your heart, you know, and that's the whole line that, Charlie Sheen makes in his voiceover at the end is like, you know, they were both kind of fathers to me. I was like their son, and they battled for my soul, which is exactly, you know, that's a great ending monologue for the movie because that kind of wraps it up. But he felt like he was fathered by both of them. He could see himself in both of them. And because really you look at them, they were both good at what they did. They were both strong leaders, and they both were effective soldiers, and they just had different styles of training and different styles of, you know, commanding. Great characters. Man.
Okay, so I looked it up. Here's the reason why Tom Berenger lost.
Oh, gosh.
Because both him and Willem Dafoe were both nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah, they probably canceled each other out.
They canceled each other out, man, and Michael Caine won for Hannah and Her Sisters.
That does not
Woody Allen movie.
Yeah, that does not make me happy.
Yeah, because I'm not a big Woody Allen fan, so
I'm not either.
That does not make me happy at all.
Yeah, but I will say, I think during that time, like, Woody Allen was winning like every year, so that was no big surprise at that time. But the Oscars don't always get it right. It's still that way now. But anyway, moving on. All right, so keep going. We'll go with Keith David as King. He's known for his signature deep voice and commanding screen presence in over 300 roles. across film, stage, television. He's been in other films such as The Thing in 82, which we've covered already on the podcast. They Live in 88, Dead Presidents in 95, Armageddon in 98. There's Something About Mary in 98, Pitch Black in 2000, Crash in 2004, The Nice Guys in 2016, Nope in 2022. I mean, he's one of those actors that he's instantly recognizable voice and just his persona, but fantastic actor. I always like him in most of the movies that he's in. And I was excited at the beginning of this when I saw him. I was like, oh man, I forgot that he would, a lot of these, like, I forgot this guy was in this movie. And so, but I like, he had a great role as well as King. Another kind of mentor for Taylor, especially early on in the movie.
Yeah, he's, I think Defoe was talking about that him and Berenger were like the only ones who have really done anything before. Like, have some seasoning under their belt.
Right.
Everybody else is just a bunch of rookies.
Yep, yep.
But yeah, he's done some voiceover work. Like you said, he's got that voice acting. I've heard his voice in several movies and shows and stuff. Like,
yeah,
I think he narrated the Bible miniseries.
He did. Yep. So he's done some video game voiceover stuff too. I didn't cover, but yeah, he's done a bunch of stuff. Then you've got Forrest Whitaker as Big Harold. After making his film debut in Fast Times at Ridgemont High in 82, he went on to earn a reputation for intensive character study work for films such as Platoon, Good Morning Vietnam in 87, Bird in 88, The Crying Game in 92, Phenomenon in 96, The Great Debaters in 2007, Respect in 2021. You know, he's been in other blockbusters like Panic Room, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, and of course, Black Panther. He did win his Best Actor Award for The Last King of Scotland in 2006, which is a phenomenal movie if you haven't seen it. Another Oscar-winning actor in it early in his career. Like, it was funny because once again, I forget that he's in this movie because I think the first movie I saw him in was Good Morning Vietnam, which came out, you know, a year or two after that. So I always think of that as being like his first movie. Of course, you know, I hadn't seen Fast Times at Ridgemont High when I was that young. But yeah, he was also in, he also has a really small brief role in Bloodsport in 88 as well.
Yeah, the first movie I saw him in was Bird, actually. I had to watch that in a college music class. So.
Gotcha. Yeah. That was directed by Clint Eastwood.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Then moving right along, we got Francesco Quinn as Ra. I mentioned him because he is the son of legendary actor Anthony Quinn. So that's not why he got the movie, but that's kind of what he was known for. As much of a massive success Platoon was, an incident while filming gave Francesco a lot of trouble later on. In the middle of filming in the Philippines, he got into a furious argument with Willem Dafoe, which led to fists being thrown. No surprise there. It gave an undeserved reputation of being a troublemaker in Hollywood, something he had to live down for a while afterwards. He did do some work on the TV series Miami Vice, but that's about all that was notable in his filmography. But I wanted to mention him because of his association with Anthony Quinn. But he was good in that role. I think Rob was a good character.
I had no idea it was Anthony Quinn's son. I didn't read up on it. That's awesome.
Yeah. And then someone else who's related to a famous actor from the 80s, Kevin Dillon as Bunny, who, of course, is the brother of Matt Dillon. Their great uncle was the cartoonist Alex Raymond, who created Flash Gordon. Put that in your trivia bucket list. Well, he did a few movies before this. This was his biggest role. In 88, he portrayed Brian Flagg in a remake of the 1958 American science fiction film, The Blob. It received mixed reviews, but was praised for its special effects and has since gained a cult following. He's probably best known for being a part of the TV show Ensemble on HBO, which was
Entourage.
Ensemble. Sorry. Yeah. I was looking at something else. Yeah. Entourage on HBO. So that's kind of where I knew him from, more so than this movie. But John Cryer, Sheen's co-star in Hot Shots and the TV show Two and a Half Men, auditioned for the role of Bunny, but lost out to Kevin Dillon, probably for good reason.
Yeah. But John Cryer got together with Sheen later on, though.
Yeah, exactly.
What was the movie that they were in together?
Hot Shots.
Hot Shots, yeah.
That's right. That must have been the connection I was thinking about earlier. So,
yeah.
And then another one of my, like, not one of the main characters, but maybe my second favorite character, John C. McGinley as Sergeant O'Neill.
He was so good, man, at playing this like complete
kiss up.
Like, yeah. and coward.
Coward, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I got a bad feeling about this one, Bob. Yeah, his voice, his accent is so it's so noticeable. But anyway, he had been cast in his first film role in Alan Alda's Sweet Liberty earlier in 86. That was followed the next year with Wall Street 87, which was also with Oliver Stone. And again, the next with Talk Radio in 88. He worked continually throughout the 90s, appearing in films such as Point Break in 91, Highlander 2, The Quickening in 91, Article 99 in 92. He was in Seven from 1995, The Rock in 96, Nothing to Lose in 97, and one of my favorites, Office Space from 1999. But of course, I know and love him from his work on Scrubs, the TV show.
Yes.
As Dr. Perry Cox.
Dr. Cox.
Which I had to use this because I was a big fan of Scrubs. Throughout the series, Dr. Cox acts as an unwilling mentor to the protagonist, JD, played by Zach Braff, if you don't know the show. McGinley has said there are three things over the course of the series that he improvised. His constant usage of girls' names for JDs, he ad-libbed all those. He said, which he does with all of his real friends. His whistle, which he describes as a bad habit, and his habit of touching his nose, a tribute to Robert Redford's character in The Sting, which he says means it's going to be okay. That makes me want to go back and watch all the episodes of Scrubs again, knowing those things are in that. But he was great. Sure. And he talked a lot. He was in both documentaries. And he was originally cast when it was going to be made in 84. And then, you know, had to basically re-audition when it got greenlit again for 86. So I thought that was pretty wild.
Oh yeah, I loved Scrubs. It does make me want to go back and watch it. Yeah, that is hilarious that he did the whole women's name thing, because that was one of the best. And he would come up with some random names like Gertrude and stuff.
Yeah,
like, come on, dude.
Yeah, and it's funny because like I remembered him being in when Scrubs came out. I remember I was like, "How is this guy going to be funny?" Because I remember him from Platoon. I remembered him from Wall Street. You know, he's been in several Oliver Stone's movies, so he always played like a very serious character. So to see him do comedy was such a hard thing for me to kind of get through the first couple episodes. But then he became like my favorite character on the show, more so than JD. Yeah. But great actor. Glad he was in this one. I want to mention Reggie Johnson as Junior only because he was such a pivotal part in the movie, but you cannot find any information about Reggie Johnson anywhere. There was nothing on Wikipedia. There was nothing in IMDb. He's briefly in one of the documentaries, like introducing himself, but he's not interviewed at all. And so I don't really know what the deal is with him, but I just wanted to reference him because his character is so important in the movie, even though you really don't like him, but that's why he's so good at it. But I was really shocked that he didn't do really anything else after this movie. So, but I wanted to mention him for sure.
Yeah. It looks like he had a couple of minor roles in a Beau Bridges directed movie called 7 Hours to Judgment, and like movies and Christopher Kane did one called the Principal, but I never heard of either one of these movies, and I didn't. Yeah,
yeah, so. I've seen The Principal. It's with Jim Belushi and Louis Gossett Jr., but it was more of like a direct straight to video kind of a B movie. Yeah. I remember watching on VHS as a kid. So, but minor roles for sure. So. Even when he's on screen, it's like I know I've seen this guy before. Like, what has he been in? He obviously has done something else. But he really hadn't, so it's kind of disappointing. All right, we're going to hit a few more. So we got Mark Moses as Lieutenant Wolf, best known for his role as Paul Young in ABC comedy drama Desperate Housewives from 2004 to 2011, and as Herman Duck Phillips in the AMC period drama Mad Men from 2007 to 2014. Another person looked really familiar, and once again, perfectly cast for the role as well. Then you've got Corey Glover as Francis. He was, at the time, he was the lead vocalist of the rock band Living Color. So he had to tell the band he was going to make a movie in the Philippines. This is his only major acting credit. But and he wanted to make everyone know that he is not Donald Glover's son. So, or not
Danny Glover.
Danny Glover. Yeah, I got the, he's not Danny Glover's son. That was, That was a direct quote on his IMDb page. So I'm sure he gets asked that a lot. And then, of course, Johnny Depp as Lerner. You know, this was, he'd already done Nightmare on Elm Street in 84, but this was his next movie that really kind of put him on the map. Of course, he was in other movies like Crybaby in 90, What's Eating Gilbert Grape in 93, Benny and June in 93, Donnie Brasco in 97. Of course, he was with Tim Burton for Edward Scissorhands in 1990, Ed Wood in 94, and Sleepy Hollow in 99. Of course, everybody now knows him as Captain Jack Sparrow in the Pirates of the Caribbean series or franchise. So, but he was kind of a blink and you miss him kind of a part in the movie. But of course, after he was such a big, once he became like a household name with 21 Jump Street, the TV show, whenever it would come on TV, everybody was like, oh my gosh, I forgot Johnny Depp was in this. Oliver Stone said he considered casting Depp for the lead role of Taylor, but Depp was too young for the part and unknown at the time. Stone said that Depp would someday become a huge star and is thus one of the first filmmakers to introduce Johnny Depp to Hollywood.
Yeah, I did not even realize it. I never watched 21 Jump Street, though. I was
too young.
A little young, a little bit too young to watch. Yeah, so, but that's interesting.
So that's it for like the main cast. There were a few other people in there that I recognize, but just for the sake of time, we won't hit them all. Unless there's anybody that you wanted to mention.
No, I mean, we got all the main people that I can even.
Yeah.
That went on to do really anything. So.
Right. So many Vietnamese refugees living in the Philippines at the time were recruited to act in different Vietnamese roles in the film. Wanted to make mention of that. And of course, Oliver Stone does make a cameo appearance as the commander of the 3rd Battalion, 22nd Infantry, and the final battle, which is based on the historic New Year's Day Battle of 1968, in which he had taken part of while on duty in South Vietnam. Dale Dye, who played Captain Harris, the commander of the Company B, is a U.S. Marine Corps Vietnam veteran who also served as the film's technical advisor. And him and Stone are basically the ones that were oversaw the boot camp and put them through the hell that they went through in that.
Yeah, and Dale Dye, he's actually been technical advisor, and he always acts in the movies that he's an advisor on. Like he's been in Saving Private Ryan, you know, Natural Born Killers, Born on 4th of July, like all Casualties of War. I don't know if you've covered that one yet or not.
I haven't yet, but yeah. Yeah, he said that after that, like he was trying to get into Hollywood doing, you know, being an advisor for these movies. And he said after the movie came out and was such a huge success, his phone, you know, started ringing off the hook. And he's like, oh, now you all want me to come and be a part of your movies. So, but yeah, but I recognized his voice and I recognized him immediately when he's on screen. I was like, he has been in so many, like played a military officer in so many movies before knowing that he was the advisor in this and knowing the backstory. Always does well in the roles that he's in.
I still need to watch Band of Brothers.
Yeah, I haven't watched it yet either. Maybe this Memorial Day, I'll get to it.
And now, these messages.
What's up, dudes? I'm Jerry D. of Totally Rad Christmas, the podcast that talks all things Christmas in the 80s. Toys, movies, specials, music, books, fashion, and fads.
If it was gnarly during Christmas in the 80s, he's got it covered. Wait, is there a lot of things to talk about for the 80s and Christmas?
Well, you got the movie giants like Christmas Vacation, Scrooged, and A Christmas Story. There are TV specials like Muppet Family Christmas, Claymation Christmas Celebration, and a Garfield Christmas Special.
Plus classics shown every year.
You also jam out to Last Christmas, Do They Know It's Christmas, and Christmas in Hollis. But most of all, it was a time for the most bodacious, best-selling Christmas toys ever, like He-Man, G.I. Joe, Transformers,
and Cabbage Patch Kids.
Yes, them too. We cover them all, plus much more, including standard segments like Hap Hap Happiest Memory, Gag Me with the Spoon, The Other Half of the Battle,
and Chant with the Littles.
So tune in to Totally Rad Christmas everywhere you get your podcasts. Turn the clock back and dive into those warm and fuzzy memories.
Later, dudes.
Hey, everybody. Do you ever just sit around with your friends and reminisce about the days and how things used to be when you were a kid or a teenager or maybe even a young adult? TV shows and the movies that you watched at the time, and how things just aren't quite the same today? Well, let me tell you, I've got the place for you. My name is Chris Adams, and I'm the host of the podcast Retro Life for You. And here at Retro Life for You, we talk about and discuss movies and TV that is retro, and we are going back from the 80s and the 90s and into the 2000s. Hey, sometimes we might even touch back to the 70s if we're feeling good. If this is for you, make sure you look for us on everywhere that you can find your podcast at. Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, Google, Stitcher, or hosted on Anchor FM. And make sure you follow us on all the major networks and leave us a rating and a review. It really does help. Look forward to hearing from you.
All right, well, let's talk about, iconic scenes. There's a couple for sure. And then favorite scenes. I guess I'll let you go first. What's the most iconic scene for you?
To me, it's got to be Elias running through the jungle, screaming, mm-hmm. getting shot over and over. And then mm-hmm. he finally falls to his knees and he lifts his arms up as he takes several shots in the chest. Mm-hmm. You see that happening, man. And you're like, how many bullets did this dude take?
Right, right.
Like, and he's still reaching up. Like, mm-hmm. that's a dude, man.
Yeah, like, yeah.
I told you he's my favorite character.
Mm-hmm.
But that scene is the one that made it on the cover of the movie,
right?
Or like
right.
A lot of the different DVDs or whatever that mm-hmm. has that yeah. cover. That's it for me though. That's the most iconic one.
Yeah, I would say that's probably the iconic scene. Of course, like I said, why it's on the cover. It wasn't the original movie poster cover, but it became like the second version of the movie poster and was on the VHSs and the DVDs, like you said. What's interesting about, like you said, about getting hit over and over again. So Oliver Stone really wanted to hire a Native American for that role, mm-hmm. but couldn't find one that, you know, kind of really fit the way he wanted to. So when he cast Willem Dafoe, he still told him, he's like, hey, I want you to have this kind of Native American spiritual essence to you. And Willem Dafoe was saying that he really, you know, that brought a lot of him, that helped him with a lot of those scenes. And I think about that scene specifically, like he's already been shot by Barnes in the middle of the jungle. Then he's running out of the jungle. He's being shot from behind and he just keeps going. But that lifting his hands to the heavens kind of gives you that thing of like, is he lift, you know, and he said, even in that scene, he was like, am I throwing my hands up because I'm being shot? Am I throwing my hands up because I'm still trying to reach the helicopter? Or am I just lifting my hands to the heaven saying, okay, this is it. I know this is the end. Take me, you mm-hmm. know, take me home kind of a thing. So, which puts that into a lot of new context as well. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say there's really favorite scenes. Like you said, favorites of things. These are not scenes that make me happy, but I don't really think they're not as going to be as iconic as that, but scenes that made an impact. I think the village scene definitely stands out. That's one that completely arrests you while it's happening. For sure did something that other movies had not done at that time. Like that was pretty groundbreaking at the time to show that level of intensity and, oh my gosh, he's not really going to do this. And he did it anyway. It showed the brutality of Barnes for sure.
Yeah. That is a heavy scene, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a lot of heavy scenes.
There's a lot. Yeah.
But I actually do have a favorite scene.
Okay. Go for it.
One that's kind of uplifting.
Lighten it up for me, please.
I'll lighten it up. It's the party scene, man.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone, they're all in this jungle, right? They're being mm-hmm. eaten by all kinds of bugs, eaten a lot. Like they can't even sleep. They're having to like wrap up in a blanket. It's mm-hmm. horrible conditions. But they all got together and they were drinking. They were, you know, doing some other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they were all like enjoying each other's company, having a good time. And then Smokey Robinson comes on and
right.
just for a moment, they're all hugged up together
mm-hmm.
and they're singing at the top of their lungs. A bunch right. of grown men, a bunch of grown military men are all right. singing right. at the top of their lungs and all hugged up together with all the joy that they have in them mm-hmm. in freaking Vietnam jungle. Like,
right.
that's such a cool scene to me,
yeah.
man. Like,
yeah.
even in the worst conditions, you can find mm-hmm. some kind of joy with your brothers, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's my manly moment. Okay.
There you go. Yeah. I was going to get there. I was going to get there.
No.
But yeah, I agree. It's like that, and it's where, you know, it's a turning point in the story too, because it's where Taylor begins to feel a part of the platoon, a part of the team, where before, you know, he's definitely the outsider. Like, he makes the comment, you know, he volunteered. Most of the guys didn't volunteer. They were drafted, so they didn't really want to be there. Like, why did you want to be here? And so he's kind of seen as the rich kid, the spoiled kid, like, you know, those kind of things. So to kind of be accepted was a big thing for him. But you also see that's another pivotal scene, because you see how the platoon is still divided, because you have Elias's guys and you have Barnes's guys. So those that are with Elias, those are with Barnes. And so, you know, Barnes and at the barracks, you know, they're playing cards and, you know, they're relaxing at their own way as well. But yeah, definitely a good scene there. One of my other favorite, quote unquote, favorite scenes, or like impactful scenes, is after, you know, of course, Taylor sees Elias get killed. And of course, I love the scene where he looks at Barnes in the helicopter. And Barnes, you can see it, like, even with the prosthetics, you know, they make his face all scarred up, which is fantastic for the character. You can see in his eyes, it's like, oh, I've been caught. They know, you know, I've been caught in a lie. And so then, you know, then it goes to the scene where they're in the barracks and, you know, Taylor's like, we got to kill him. You know, he killed Elias, saw it in his eyes. Da, da, da. And all of a sudden there's Barnes in the barracks, kind of high in the back. And he has his whole speech about, you think, you know, I just watched it and I can't think of the words, but that whole scene of him confronting them is just so well done. And once again, shows how great of an actor Tom Berenger was in that role.
Yeah, that was Berenger said that was him trying to go and apologize, but you know that those words are never going to come out of his mouth.
Yeah, exactly.
So he ends up with Taylor on the ground with a knife to his throat. You know,
It's wild. And there's another scene with Barnes that I like too, where after the explosion, after the guys got blew up, they thought they had found like some VC stuff, and they were about to pick up the little metal case it was in. And of course the whole thing blew up, and Taylor kind of walks up on Barnes just sitting next to it and smoking. And you can tell he's trying to process what's just happened. And it's like, Taylor sees him in this kind of vulnerable moment. And then when Barnes sees him looking at it, he kind of, you know, backs up. But just another great, just little nuances of the story that, you know, shows that Barnes is human, that he's evil. You know, he's doing some bad things. He, you know, he's looking out for number one, because, you know, he shot Elias basically to keep from getting in trouble for what they did at the village. But in this scene, you kind of see like he still has to deal with the death that he sees. He still deals with the loss of his soldiers, men that he fought next to. So there's still emotion in him. There's still care in him, even though he's not going to let them see that, you know, in public. He was trying to have a private moment. So that was a scene that really I kind of paid more attention to this time.
Oh, for sure. For sure. What about when he, after he had the falling out with Chris, and like he knew, and the whole, when he goes down from, and like, he was about to like, stab him, right?
Yeah.
And then this bomb comes down and he goes flying, and he's like dragging, like, and then he tells Chris, he says, go get me a medic, boy. And it's like, dude, you were about to kill me.
right.
Are you kidding me right now?
Still trying to be in control.
He's still trying to be the man. I'm like, dude, come on now.
Yeah.
Oh gosh.
Yeah, that's another intense scene. Lord. Like that whole confrontation at the end. And then, I wanted to mention this. I don't know if this was in your documentary that you sent or the other one, but Charlie Sheen was talking about that the following scene where he's sitting there and the other platoon kind of walks up on him. And I didn't notice it until he talked about it, but he was actually holding a grenade. And he said that he went to Oliver and he was like, you know, I think after this, I think Taylor's wants to end it. I think he's holding that grenade, thinking about just dropping it and ending it all. And he said, when those guys come in, he drops it with the pin still in it, because he was about to do it. And then he got caught and then he decided not to, which I thought was just a, you know, and he said, Oliver's almost like, do it, you know, and that just brings them living those characters, like that kind of a thought coming out. So I was like, that's pretty heavy. I mean, yeah, but you got to think all that he had been through that night with that battle, you know, half of the guys, you know, dying, the napalm being dropped, and him, you know, finally you know, shooting Barnes, and it, you know, it's not really said, but it's kind of understood that, yeah, he, in his mind, he's like, yeah, I'm going to kill Barnes for what he did to Elias. But you could tell, like, after he shot him, there was that conflict on the inside of, like, am I any better than the man I just killed now? Because I, you know, Barnes shot Elias in cold blood, and I did the same thing. So what's the difference between me and him in this moment? Kind of a thing, which may have led him to thinking about the grenade. But anyway, it is a lot. I mean, this is a multi-layered movie. Like we said, you know, every time I watch it, I see something different, or there's other things that come up in it. And it's just that type of movie where you need multiple viewings to kind of catch some of those nuances and see different parts of the story that's being told. That's how great movies are made, for sure.
For sure, man. And this is one of those that we could go on and on and on about. Yeah, we might end up being really depressed if we talk too much
about it. Right. Yeah. It's like we're about to start wrapping this thing up. So any other scenes you want to talk about before we talk a little bit about trivia?
Oh man, I think we covered it. Like I said, there's so many heavy scenes in this film. It's mm-hmm. just, it's hard to nail them all.
Yeah. All right. We'll hit some trivia. And if we think of something else, we'll add it in. So the U.S. Department of Defense declined to cooperate in the making of the film. Military equipment was loaned from the armed forces of the Philippines. So yeah, the U.S. Department of Defense didn't like the way the war was portrayed in the movie. So they didn't want to have any involvement with it. Yeah, one scene we didn't, another heart heavy scene we didn't talk about was the scene with Kevin Dillon, Bunny, and Taylor, and the boy with one leg and the cataract, and tormenting him in the village, one of the other villages. But Kevin Dillon said he flipped out when they filmed the scene where his character beats the villager boy to death because the guy he was doing it to was a Filipino the filmmakers had picked up somewhere. He was actually deaf and blind in one eye and missing a leg. Dillon felt bad for the guy because he was a nervous wreck the whole time, and Dillon wasn't sure if he knew they were just filming a movie. The scene was so intense that even his mom couldn't bear to watch it. The young man had cataracts, but his family was too poor to pay for treatment. Here's your bright side. Reportedly, Dillon and Sheen felt so bad about this, they pooled money together so the boy could get the surgery to fix his cataracts. So,
wow.
Little feel-good story there for you.
There you go.
I saw this, I put this in because I remember this scene where just before the initiation of the end battle, an NVA soldier is seen planting a yellow axe made of bamboo. And I was like, I wondered why that was like, it was such a weird kind of shot. Like they zoomed, you know, it's like a slow zoom in on it. And so it says the axe was a pointer to guide the NVA soldiers to the American base. So that was kind of, I guess, kind of an inside thing that Stone knew about, that that's what they used to kind of tell the other NVA where to go. Yeah. I think that's all I'm going to cover for trivia. There'll be other stuff that I'll put in the show notes, but there's a lot of stuff. I mean, we, like I said, we can talk, you know, the good thing about doing so much research, you have so much stuff you can pull from and just keep talking about different stories or whatever. So
one thing that I just thought about was that one scene, and you know, Oliver wrote this, so it probably happened this way. Mm-hmm. When Elias was talking to Chris, and Elias just comes right out and says, man, we're going to lose this war.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And Chris is like, oh, come on. Are you serious? Like, nobody thought America could lose anything, right?
Right.
Like,
right.
Nobody thought.
Right.
But here's this soldier who's there, and he's coming
to terms
with the fact that this ain't happening. Mm-hmm. Like we're going to lose this war. And he says, mm-hmm. we've been kicking other people's, you know, what's for mm-hmm. so long. It's time that we got ours kicked.
Yeah. Yeah. That line stood out to me for sure.
Oh man.
And I think Dale Dye talked about, he said they didn't think the movie was going to do very well because it was so different than what American audiences had seen in other war movies. And so, first of all, they were surprised that it became such a box office success and the critics loved it or whatever. But Dale Dye said he would take cuts of the movie to other veterans for them to see, to find out what they thought. And, you know, for them to say that they felt like someone finally got it right. And then the good and the bad of that is, like, you had a lot of veterans that came out of the woodwork and said, you know, thank you for telling our story. I haven't been able to talk to my family about the things that I've seen, so I'm taking them to the movie so they can at least have some kind of context of what we endured and what we went through there. But then you had the other side of the people that came out of the woodwork that were then didn't like the movie because they were like, they didn't like the way the military was portrayed. They didn't like that, you know, seeing the soldiers doing the things they did. And he said, but, you know, that was the dichotomy of the nation at that time. It was like those that were anti-war saw the things in the movie that said it was anti-war, but then you had other people that saw it with pro-war went in and saw the things that he's like, I don't think Oliver made a movie that was anti-war. I think he just tried to show them he wanted to show them what he experienced. He said, and there's thousands of soldiers that fought in the conflict, in the war, and they all had different experiences. It's, we weren't saying this is the only experience. We were just giving them what our experience that we had. So everybody didn't have the same experience, but we wanted to show a different side of what we experienced. So I thought that was important to say on the podcast and about the movie, because my plan is to release this on Memorial Day, Memorial Day weekend. And I do like how the movie ends with a dedication to all those who fought and died in the Vietnam War, because, you know, that's what Memorial Day is about. It's about remembering our veterans and the price they paid. You know, yeah, the Vietnam War is not a war that America is really proud about. And for a lot of reasons, it shouldn't be. But we still had brave men that went and fought for their country and laid down their life for a cause, even if they didn't understand why they were there or agree with why they were there, but they were doing it for their country. And so I just, you know, want to commend any veterans that may be listening to the episode. Thank you for your service. Thank you for what you do. And I hope and I pray that we never put ourselves in another conflict like that again. I hope we learn from our history and don't make the same mistakes we've made in the past. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, the interviewed some Vietnam vets.
Yeah,
one of the documentaries, the one that I watched, and a lot of them were saying, you know, how the movie, you know, they used to be ashamed to be a Vietnam vet because they were so talked down. Everybody thought bad of them, and even they, you know, were so ashamed. But after watching that movie and seeing it on screen like that, it made them proud to be a Vietnam vet. And so, like that's just cool that Stone can do something like that. And like you said, it's him paying tribute to everyone who fought, gave their lives, and lived through it. And
I think even looking at it, even now looking at it, like, I don't think that the intent of the movie was not to glorify what they did. Like, I didn't see it. It isn't made that way. I think it's just he's trying to be authentic. How he put the actors through the boot camp and how he filmed the things the way he did and showed things that he experienced. And he even said, he was like, you know, he said one of the things he hated doing was going to those villages. And he said, because, you know, you never knew who was VC and who wasn't. He said, you know, and some were and some weren't. He said, but we didn't know. We didn't have any good intelligence. We really didn't. We were going on instinct. He said, that's not always the best thing to do. He said, so it's a shame that I only showed one instance of that, but that was a part of the movie that we needed to see. He said, but, you know, every village wasn't that way. He said, that's just one that was in that story. So take it all in context. All right, well, let's talk about box office and wrap this thing up. So it was released in the United States on December 19th, 1986. What a great movie for Christmas. and in the Philippines, United Kingdom on March of 87. In its seventh weekend of release, the film expanded from 214 theaters to 590 and became number one at the U.S. box office. It remained number one for 4 weeks. And its ninth weekend, it grossed $12.9 million from 1,194 theaters over the four-day President's Day weekend, being the first film to gross more than $10 million in a weekend in February and setting a weekend record for Orion Pictures. But that's wild. It was limited release for 6 weeks before it went wide. but was it number one when it went wide? So it's pretty, pretty good. Great word of mouth, I'm sure, for that. So critical reception, no surprise here. 89% on Tomato Meter with a 93% audience score. And then, which is interesting because it's almost flipped on IMDb. It's got an 8.1 out of 10 with viewers and a 92 on Metacritic. The critics gave it was, you know, high 80s, audience in the 90s. And then on IMDb, the viewers have it at 8 and Metacritic in the 90s. So what about you? Where does it fall for you? Is it a top tier?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's I have it at a 4.5 kind of teeter. I could almost say it's a five-star movie. But man, it's Vietnam. It's hard for me to say anything's like I gotta be able to rewatch it, and I can't rewatch this that often.
This one doesn't have the rewatchability.
But I did say in my review that if you asked me what my favorite Vietnam movie was, I would either say it would be the last movie that I watched between Platoon, Full Metal Jacket, or Apocalypse Now. But if you really put a gun to my head and ask me, okay, for real, tell me what's your favorite, it's going to be Platoon all day, every day.
Yeah.
So, so visceral, man. Like, it's just, but it's hard, man. It's hard to watch, but it's, it's the best in my opinion, though, as far as Vietnam goes.
Yeah, I watched Apocalypse Now for the first time last Memorial Day. So I've seen that a year ago, and I appreciate that film for what it is, like knowing, you know, kind of knowing some of the backstory before watching it, but kind of just watching it, you kind of understand the heaviness of it. This one's a little more palpable in the sense of being able to kind of, it's still heavy and rough, but I think it delivers a little bit better than I think Apocalypse Now does. I've only seen Full Metal Jacket maybe once or twice, and I have not watched it recently. So I can't really rank that one because I didn't like it when I was younger, but I know now it's probably because I didn't understand it like I would understand watching it now. So that's you know, I want to record first and then watch it because I know it's also on, well, it's not HBO Max anymore. Now it's just Max, but I watched Platoon on Max and now I know Full Metal Jacket is on there as well. So I was like, after I record, get all this out of my system, then I'm going to go back and rewatch Full Metal Jacket. And so I can like you have that. A lot of people there's that divide of there's those that, you know, prefer Full Metal Jacket, those that prefer Platoon. So I wanted to kind of watch them close together and say which one would I put above the other. But I think Platoon may win out just because I have more memory. I have more nostalgia with Platoon than I do with Full Metal Jacket, but we'll see. It might surprise me. Stay tuned. we might cover that one next year. Yeah.
It's a great movie, man. Yeah. I covered it with an episode of Manly Movies. So, it's a good one to watch. It's a good one to talk about, man. So I look forward to the future episode that you do maybe next year.
Cool. Well, thanks, man, so much for being a part of this episode. Always a pleasure to have you. So what's going on with Manly Movies for the month of June? What you got coming up?
Start with Memorial Day. Actually, I'm going to be dropping Saving Private Ryan, which features yours truly here, Mr. Tim Williams.
Yes.
Which is a great episode and a great, great, great movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to do a special, and me and a guest host, Byron Lafayette, are going to discuss our favorite movie dads and TV dads.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, so it's just something different that I'm doing. And then I'm not sure what Father's Day movie I'm going to drop. It might be Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I'm just going to say that.
Well, maybe Splinter was kind of a father figure, so I guess that works.
I've got a couple of father movies in the bank. I'm not sure which one it's going to be yet. So
that might be
the one, though. We'll see.
Cool deal. Well, definitely check out Manly Movies, the podcast that JB hosts. It's a great one. I've been on there a couple of times. He always has good, insightful guests and talks about great movies to learn about being a man, a husband, a father. I'm trying to do your whole shtick, but I can't get it all down.
A husband, a father, a son, and a brother.
There it is.
I'm not an expert on any of those things, but I do the best I can.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. All right. So be sure to follow, subscribe, rate, and review both of our podcasts. Support the show through buymeacoffee.com. You can also buy a t-shirt. Hey, it's summertime. Get those t-shirts for your trips to the beach or going on vacation. You can get those at our website, 80sflickflashback.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with someone who loves 80s flicks. And you can also follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. All right, JB, thanks so much again for being a part. And thanks, everybody, for listening. I'm Tim Williams for the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. Good night, good people.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.